Everyone has their own unique views and needs when it comes to financial success. If you'd like to leave your financial woes behind and live a life of financial freedom, you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Saving with Steve Show, hosted by Steve Sexton. The show will help you with the ins and outs of money. We talk about financial issues that could be costing you thousands of dollars and keeping you up at night. We talk about money, tax reduction, saving more, spending less, 401ks, risk management, retirement, and everything under the sun that relates to you having a healthier, happy relationship with money. Now, here is your host of Saving with Steve, Steve Sexton, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to the Saving with Steve Show, where we talk about the ins and outs of money. Pretty much everything in the sun relates to you having a happier, healthier relationship with money. My name is Steve Sexton. I want to thank you for joining us today. We've got a really unique topic that is spreading not only here in the States, but throughout the world. We got emails from viewers from far away from Australia, Europe, here in the United States. And you know, you might have noticed this, but everywhere you look, from celebrities to influencers, maybe your friends, women are removing their implants and talking about symptoms nobody warned them about. John Kineski is our guest today. He's a board-certified plastic and reconstructive surgeon in Los Angeles, a data scientist, founder in the medical AI space. He's also advises on surgical robotics. Women actually travel from around the world to work with him because he treats more than just the procedure. He helps patients understand what is happening in their bodies and guides them back to real health. So, John, I want to welcome you to the show. I really appreciate you being here, and I know our listeners are.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me on and for talking about such an important public health issue.
This is gigantic. So, you know, obviously you're a plastic surgeon, breast implants, all sorts of things go along with that. What causes health issue for you to get involved?
So during my training, I started to notice a trend among patients, which is they thought their implants were making them sick. And like many health issues, it often is sort of a canary in a coal mine situation where there is a little blip on the radar that gets on the that happens in the office among physicians, where they'll start to notice the patient bring up a concern. And because there's so much momentum behind medical training and the way that education goes, it's not until it becomes a big problem that people start to pay attention and notice. So towards the end of my training as a plastic surgeon in my fellowship, I noticed an increased frequency. So more and more patients were coming in saying, I think my implants are making me sick. And by and large, the plastic surgery community about 10 years ago was pretty much blind to this. There'd been so much research, so much evidence showing that breast implants are safe, that most surgeons would stick by that evidence and say, you know, it's probably something that patients are, it's in their heads. It's not really a thing. Fortunately, the medical community is starting to come around and take more caution as well as listen more carefully to patients. But I still don't think it's enough. I think the implants by and large are not safe and have created what I think is probably the evidence of the largest medical gaslighting that's happened in the medical industry by promoting something that's not safe repeatedly to women for a number of reasons. But for me specifically, the stake in the sand, the line in the sand for my medical practice and career was towards the end of my fellowship. It's about over 8 years ago now, where I noticed that patients were getting sick from their implants, and consistently about 30% of patients would have some sort of complication with their implant. And I decided until I could further definitively decide which patients would have a reaction to an implant or not, I would no longer use breast implants. And I focused my career on removing implants, as well as providing a safe and natural alternative to breast implants, which is fat grafting.
Wow. Now, so what you're telling me is you've been noticing this. This has been occurring for a while. And just like with any industry that wants to turn a blind eye, like you said, they gaslight it. And it's not until it really starts hitting everybody in the face, which means class action lawsuits, that they start doing something about it.
Correct. And if you look at, you know, many health trends and things that doctors and patients have, it's always this sort of dance, you know, it comes from a place of good intention. Usually it's, you know, they want to promote and provide the best possible treatment with the best evidence for it. But at some point, doctors were also promoting cigarettes as a safe and natural thing to do until, you know, enough research and evidence came to light that that is not a safe thing. And breast implants have an interesting varied history because over decades, generations, this has happened multiple times. It started, the history of breast implants is pretty interesting, as well as the controversy of the history around breast implants is interesting. In the 80s and 90s, it started with a moratorium on breast implants when a group of rheumatologists noted that an increased incidence of autoimmune-like symptoms were occurring in women with silicone implants. And the rheumatologist published, rheumatologists are doctors that focus on skin, joint, hair, nails, things like that. So basically all auto or immune-mediated diseases that affect the body. And what they noticed is that there was an increased incidence among these autoimmune symptoms among women who had silicone breast implants. And they described a symptom known as ASIA, so silicone-mediated autoimmune response, that led to symptoms such as hair loss, fatigue, dry eyes, skin rashes, joint pain, and a number of other symptoms that fell under this constellation of silicone-mediated autoimmune response. In the 80s and or it was in the 90s, this was reported to the FDA. Patients reported this, and the FDA put a moratorium on breast implants, so no more silicone implants. After that time, there was a number of studies that were done that were, if you look back on it, somewhat questionable in terms of how they were funded, how the evidence was based, and so that was when saline implants were introduced. Now, a saline breast implant is one that still has a silicone shell, but is filled with saline, so salt water instead of silicone. In some ways, potentially safer, but the immune response from the body is effectively the same because the body still has to respond to a silicone shell. So a foreign body is placed inside, and the natural response of the body always, forever has been, biology hasn't changed, is to create a wall of inflammation around the implant. So for the implants come back in the market in the late 90s, early 2000s, and then they continue. There's been tons of research around implants, so they're always trying to iterate and make them safer and better. But the core, you know, the first principles of what an implant is has not changed. It's still a foreign body. Then in the late 2010s, about, you know, 10 years ago or so, there was a discovery of breast implant-associated anaplastic large cell lymphoma, which is a rare but maybe not so rare type of cancer associated with textured implants. So that led eventually to what's now known as the black box warning on the FDA, and textured implants were recalled. So now we have one major problem with implants that's been known. It's this rare type of cancer. A second commonly known problem with implants is capsular contracture, which is when the body, the inflammatory wall that the body builds around an implant becomes excessively hard and painful, which is something that many women, again, the incidence is anywhere from about, it ranges depending on the literature you look at, but from 10 to 30%. And that's a very painful, can be a very painful and also unsightly reaction to the implant that requires secondary surgery.
And can then, I add something there?
Sure.
One of the ladies actually emailed in because they've had that, and they said their implants are like softballs. They're like roughs. Super hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And that happens because if you imagine, you know, anything from accidentally stabbing your finger with a pencil and a piece of lead getting stuck in there, or graphite or whatever the pencil is made out of, or to a piercing, or literally any implant, anything that's not your own natural biological tissue, the body has a natural response. It's a very intelligent machine that has evolved over thousands of millions of years to create this wall of inflammation to protect the body from whatever this foreign body is. And the implant is no different. The implant creates a foreign body reaction, creates a capsule, and that capsule has four layers. And those four layers are a mixture of scar tissue and immune cells that are building this wall of inflammation. They're literally building a wall around the implant. Now, some women have very thin and non-inflammatory capsules or capsules with less inflammation. And unfortunately, some women develop a very hard fibrotic capsule. So the wall around that implant gets very hard, and which is why women feel that sort of softball, very hard texture. So we talked about cancer, we talked about capsular contracture. The third and more commonly discussed but harder to diagnose problem with implants is breast implant illness, or it's been recently re-diagnosed or classified as SBII, which is just another term for breast implant associated issue caused by silicone. And this is more of the symptoms of BII or SBII are more, they're a bit more vague because there's not a very clear, easy way to diagnose it, but it's more the symptoms that are autoimmune. So fatigue, joint pain, hair loss, dry eyes, skin rashes, and a number of also some mental health issues that have anything from anxiety and OCD that some women report.
Oh, wow.
The challenge with that diagnosis and constellation of symptoms is that many other things can cause that. you know, any number of hormone disruptions or autoimmune issues unrelated to implants can also cause the symptoms. And that is why I believe for a long time women were gaslit and not believed, is because many other things can cause those problems. Even just having the psychological fear, the psychosomatic, so believing, you know, the psychology behind why the body will manifest certain things can cause those problems. And it is for those three reasons. So the cancer, the capsular contracture, as well as BII, the autoimmune symptoms. I think breast implants are not safe, should not be used anymore. And we should be focusing on safer, more natural alternatives.
That's perfect. Hey, yeah. Folks, you want to stick with us? We'll be right back with more Saving with Steve and Dr. John.
More expert advice for having a happier relationship with money still to come on the Saving with Steve show on UK Health Radio.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the show that is here to help you achieve your financial goals. It's the Saving with Steve show. Now here's your host, Steve Sexton, on UK Health Radio.
Hey folks, welcome back to the Saving with Steve show, where we talk about all the ins and outs of money. Everything in the sun relates to you having a happier, healthy relationship with money. Folks, all the replays are available at savingwithsteve.us. If you're enjoying the stories of helpful insight on Saving with Steve, I encourage you to subscribe to our YouTube channel. Never miss a show. Check out a few of our affiliates at UK Health Radio, BBS Radio, Talk Radio in New York City, E360 TV, Las Vegas TV Network, as well as AMFM 247. All these networks are dedicated to empowering you to solve problems, uplift your spirit, and live a life of personal and financial freedom. Again, you can check us out at Saving with Steve Sexton on Facebook. Check out the Insiders Club. Get guest gifts, the whole shot. We're back here with Dr. John, and we're talking about breast implants. And you know what? It was really interesting. I didn't even know breast implants had all those issues over the years. And there's one other thing that you have that you wanted to share with us to make sure everybody knew.
Yeah, I wanted to share with you. So first of all, I want to show you what these implants look like. You know, this is literally just a bag of silicone, and these are sold to patients for, they're very expensive. The implant, even though the cost to make them could be not that expensive, you know, $1,000 is usually the cost of an implant to produce something that is essentially just a bag of silicone. The interesting thing is that there's this resurgence of new research to try and make a safer, better implant, which is being sold to the plastic surgery community as well as to patients. And I just wanted to point out why I still think it's ridiculous and unsafe. The newer generation of implant claims to have less issues, to be safer to put into the body. And the unsettling trend that I see is that implants are getting smaller. And so it's trying to promote to patients a smaller, safer implant. When in reality, to me, that sounds like doctors trying to peddle or promote a smaller, skinnier cigarette. Still just as unsafe, but is smaller, and which is something that could easily be achieved with fat grafting. So this is an implant. It has a silicone shell. It's filled with silicone. And what's commonly just said is, you know, well, the inside is a gummy bear material. It's a cohesive gel implant, meaning if you cut it open, the silicone kind of stays contained. What often happens with these implants is that the gel can bleed through its capsule over time. So it just kind of leaches out into the body. And The way that implants are commonly discussed and promoted on social media is, you know, you can say, oh, look how safe these are. We can drive a car over them. We can drop them from the top of a building and nothing happens to them. Well, that's just about the dumbest way I've ever heard of anything being advertised or promoted, because the truth is these implants sit at body temperature, so about, you know, 98 degrees and for decades. So that would be a more appropriate way to test if something, what's happening in the body. And over time, the contents of the implant can slowly leach on the surface. And so the silicone is still getting into the body and the body is still reacting to them. So regardless of how new or impressive the implant is, unless the fundamental science has changed, which is this is still just a foreign body going inside, sitting there for decades, it's still the same problem.
So here's a question that we received from our listeners. Some people felt that if they were to be in an accident, got hit there or something like that, that's what causes them to leak. But what you're telling me is it's entirely different than that. It just could be the fact that it's 98 degrees over time and these things break down.
Absolutely. So the newer implants may break down less, but there's still the phenomenon of gel bleed. And there's two ways to think about how the silicone from inside the implant can get to outside. The first is what we just talked about, which is gel bleed. And the second is trauma. So certainly receiving some sort of strong impact, any kind of puncture or anything like that, can cause the implant wall to rupture. And that leads to something that we can pick up on an MRI or a scan.
Okay. So now I want to start getting into talking about TikTok, Instagram, the filters that are being used, or you can see somebody, they look beautiful after those filters. And it's fueling this wave of cosmetics procedures. More importantly, the issue is for younger and younger patients or people.
Yeah. I would say now more than ever, there's never been a more dire need for everybody, but specifically women and young women who are exposed to social media, to have a strong foundation in their mental health and the way that they view themselves with love and compassion. The reason for that is because we're being inundated many times a day, hundreds of times a day, every time you open your phone to see social media, to be inundated with comparison to what you could look like or what something is like if it's more attractive. Now, if you go back 50 years, 60 years, the average person would look at some sort of content maybe 3, 5, 10 times a day. And that content would be a movie, a magazine cover, maybe their more attractive best friend or something like that. And that would be a data point of comparison. You'd look at, you know, a magazine cover and say, oh, wow, what a beautiful celebrity on the cover of this magazine, fully done up and artistic and whatever. And that creates a point of comparison. And comparison is the thief of joy. And so you look at this beautiful person and say, wow, you know, that's a really incredible dress, or her makeup looks amazing, something like that. And that's, you know, that happened a few times a day, or you'd go see a movie or something like that. Again, commercial, a few times a day. But now, literally every time you open your phone, hundreds of times a day, you know, the average person, I think, looks at their phone 70 to 100 times a day. Who knows how many hours spending on social media? You're being inundated time and time again with examples of what you can compare yourself to. And it's no longer just a celebrity or a movie star or somebody on the cover of a magazine. It's now filters that allow you to compare yourself to something that's completely unattainable, which is a far more attractive, far more artificial version of yourself. And what that does to the psyche, and what I think it's done to a generation of people, but specifically young women, is create very early on this self-perpetuating feeling of not enough, of unworthiness. And it's really like a mind battle over time. I feel fortunate to have grown up in a time before cell phones, where this was not a thing. So I can at least remember a little bit what that time is like. But being a young teenage girl nowadays must be intense, because it's mental warfare constantly happening on social media. So in response to your question, I think now more than ever, there's a need to help reframe and create a healthy mindset in relation to how we view our own bodies.
You know what? It's really interesting. Some of my listeners are involved with the National Charity League. It's moms and daughters doing charitable work, and it's just typically high schoolers on up. And one of them was telling me about this one meeting that they had with 200 girls there, and somebody says, "What is your biggest concern?" And it's not being enough. And that was kind of a scary thing for all those moms to hear, that their little daughters are saying, "Hey, I don't think I'm enough." And the comparison is exactly what you said. It's the influencers, it's the TikToks. Not so much the stars anymore. It's just how somebody else that seems to be normal, regular, that's not a star, could look that good, and so could they.
And it's never ending. And the reality is it's only going to get more and more. Right now, all major tech companies are competing for our eyeballs and time, basically competing against time sleeping. So the time that we spend awake is potentially time that you could be shown images, you could be interacting with your device, and that most of the time it's social media. And I think you're absolutely right. It creates this perpetual feeling of you are not enough. So the more activities, content and things like that that can promote feelings of self-worth, self-love, compassion are helpful in that way.
Okay. So, I mean, obviously one of the methods is, hey, get off Facebook and all that, but that's just not going to happen. So, you know what? What would you recommend to people, like if you've got a young girl coming in, what would you say, hey, what is your, you know, what is there a conversation that you go with there, or how can parents deal with that?
Yeah. And you know, the answer isn't necessarily you should never do anything to your body or never do anything that will make you feel or look good, because there's the alternate side to this, which is feeling good, looking good. They go hand in hand, and it creates this air of self-confidence. And if you, a really common buzzword nowadays is aura. What is your aura? And aura doesn't always necessarily have to look with that correspond to how you look. It's part of it, but there's something deeper to aura, which is it's how you carry yourself, how you view yourself. Who are the people you interact with? What are the things you talk about, the things you think about? And I think the spheres of influence that we're surrounded by, despite having such far reaches with social media and being impacted by people halfway across the globe, it's still really important who are the people closest to you and what kind of messages are they giving back to you. So I think the message to especially teenage young girls, I have nieces, they're 14 years old, and they're fortunately not on social media yet, but I still see how big of an impact the world around them has on them. And so to make sure that there's immediate social circles, one that reflects back to them those messages of self-love, positivity, focusing on things that are beyond just their physical appearance that can give them feelings of self-worth. So that's doing things of service, you know, working on things outside of beauty that make you feel strong and good. So whether that's sports and focusing on intellect and you know, personal growth, self-growth, studying, all those things, it seems painfully obvious to say, but at the same time, I don't think if there's a dedicated focus on that, you know, if a weekend activity is shopping and makeup and things like that, that's going to reinforce a lot of those things. So I think the easiest way to think about it is who are your kids' immediate social circles and what kind of activities are they doing that might be either promoting that kind of self-conscious awareness of who they are and what they look like versus helping them expand and grow as a person.
Yeah. And I'm really glad you said, you know, you just can't tell them to put anything in their body because, you know, well, you have nieces and nephews. I've had teenagers. I know that's never going to work.
Yeah. And the truth is, you know, it's kind of a spectrum. I think of the body as like we have these avatars that are on loan for a brief period of time, hopefully more than 100 years in the future. And our bodies, you know, people wake up and do their hair in the morning. They put on makeup, they brush their teeth. We care about the way we look because it is a outwardly reflection of how we feel on the inside. And surgery is on that spectrum, but it's on the way further, more extreme end of the spectrum because it involves the much more invasive approach. But I see it as a spectrum, you know, whether or not you wake up in the morning and have a face care routine, somewhere way further along that line is surgery on the end of the spectrum. So it is on a spectrum, but I think it always comes back to the intention of why are you doing this? How does it make you feel? And how safe and what are the risks and benefits of any procedure?
That's wonderful. Hey, folks, you want to stick with us? We'll be right back with more Saving with Steve. Got Dr. Gronexy with us. He's talking about TikTok, social media, issues with breast implants, but now we're going to talk about a clear look at how the medical world missed or ignored the early warning signs of breast implant illness. And this is one of the things that I've asked Dr. John to talk about, the symptoms that you should be looking at if you're dealing with that right now, so you just don't ignore it.
So when patients come in concerned about their implants, I usually have a few questions that I ask to better understand where they're at and what they're feeling. And full disclosure, not everybody who has implants is going to have these symptoms or have a bad reaction to them. And part of the challenges with social media is that you can read some of these things. And if the symptoms are vague, you know, who hasn't felt fatigued at some point? Who hasn't felt some joint pain? So it's the constellation of symptoms that can be a little bit misleading because other things can cause what we think is breast implant illness or the symptoms associated with breast implant illness. So some of the questions I ask, and for me, the timeline is very important, is, you know, when did these symptoms start? Was it before or after the implants? And what are the symptoms? And I've had a number of patients, just yesterday I was doing consultations and I had three patients back to back in a row saying, I noticed a significant change in my health after I got implants. Usually, and the symptoms I was hearing yesterday, but it's pretty consistent, it's I started to lose my hair. I started to have these weird rashes that would develop. I started to have certain pains in my body. I had joint pain. I noticed that my nails started to look different. The first thing I ask is, you know, is there something that's going on that's not related to the implants that we need to check on? At the end of the day, all plastic surgeons are still medical doctors and need to make sure that there's not a larger, easily more directly explainable cause for some of these. So I work with primary care doctors and rheumatologists to do a workup just to make sure that there's no thyroid issues, that there's no issues with other hormones such as cortisol or estrogen or basically to make sure that there's nothing else that could be causing these problems. Once that's clear and there's no clear evidence that something else is causing those symptoms, then breast implant illness is still considered a diagnosis of exclusion. So we've ruled out everything else that's possible. And now the last remaining thing is possibly the implants. Now, the majority of the time when the implants are removed and the capsule around them is removed, many patients experience an improvement in symptoms as high as about 70%. But it is very important that I tell patients that just removing the implants alone is not necessarily going to remove all of the symptoms. But the classic symptoms to look out for that may be caused by the implants are autoimmune related. And so those things include joint pain, hair loss, skin rashes, fatigue, dry eyes. And then those are the most common ones that I see. And then there's some psychological symptoms too, such as anxiety, OCD, depression. And because these are such broad symptoms, it may be hard to say exactly when they started or how often they're experienced because so many things can cause those problems. But those are usually the constellation symptoms that I see reported the most.
Okay. So when we look at when you talk about joint pain, rashes, those type of things, they usually are added to other symptoms that they're experiencing at the same time. Is that correct?
Correct.
So it's a whole myriad of things that are occurring at the same time that somebody says, hey, this is probably part of this.
And that's, in the medical world, that's the difference between a disease and a syndrome. A syndrome is usually something without a clear diagnosis that is a constellation of symptoms. So number of symptoms that seem to fit a consistent pattern that is not easily diagnosable by, let's say, a blood test or something. So unfortunately, there's no definitive test for breast implant illness. There's no blood test that you can do. There's no specific scan, but it is usually a constellation, a number of symptoms that seem to fit the syndrome.
Okay. So now you talked about 70% of the time, those symptoms are going away. But what happens on the other 30% and what can be done if, hey, the breast implants are taken out? Is there something else that's there? Or is it just one of those things where that chemical's in the body? And let you answer.
So in my experience, and what seems to be consistent among other surgeons who work in the space, is that once the implant's removed, the body then needs to go through a process of clearing out a lot of the inflammation that's associated with the implant. And there's a large number of things that patients have reported to me that help, but I can't say that there's any specific thing that needs to be done. And I'm careful to promote anything to say that this is exactly the protocol that needs to be done after implants are removed. But I'll still share some of them that are anecdotally that patients have shared that this really helps. So there's some supplement protocols that patients have reported that help, things like supplementing with glutathione. Sauna afterwards, which is interesting because sauna is one of the best ways to excrete certain toxins from the body, such as forever chemicals like microplastics, PFAS, bisphenol. The heavy metals in implants are interesting. So a lot of the implant production process involves use of heavy metals in either the silicone shell or part of the internal products. And so patients have reported that using certain chelating therapies, so that's a blood therapy that helps bind. So it can either be done orally or through the vein, which helps bind some of the toxic heavy metals that are associated with implants. The reason I'm careful not to say this is the definitive protocol for afterwards is because there's not a ton of evidence that shows this is always what needs to be done. But I listen very carefully to my patients and they say, this really helped me afterwards. And as long as you're choosing a protocol after surgery that doesn't have significant either health risk or financial risk, meaning it's not a super expensive thing to do, I think it's worth trying. And the most easy, common ways to do that is supporting diet. So good, healthy, low inflammatory diet. And as well as things like sauna, red light therapy have also been helpful for patients, as well as some of the supplements that I mentioned.
I do have one question about red light therapy now that you've said it.
Sure.
How does that benefit a patient? Is it just help reduce inflammation? What does it do?
So red light therapy is interesting because I've kind of gone from one end of the spectrum saying, I don't think it does anything, to now I actually think there's some benefit. I don't think red light therapy does everything it's advertised to, but specifically in the surgeries I do in the world of fat transfer and fat grafting, I think it is extremely beneficial. And so what red light therapy does at a cellular level, the infrared light helps stimulate the mitochondria cells. And the mitochondria, being the powerhouse of the cell, helps drive a lot of processes that can lower inflammation. So the cells become more active, specifically the stem cells that are active in fat transfer. And it helps those cells grow. It also helps promote the development of new blood vessels. That's a process known as angiogenesis. And it helps new blood vessels grow into areas, which helps improve oxygen delivery. And that's an essential part of lowering inflammation. And it also shows that the immune cells in those areas become more efficient and more active at what they're supposed to be doing. So clearing debris and helping basically cell regeneration, cell turnover.
Thank you. That was one big question that everybody, does it
Yeah.
help?
And you know, it's shown to be helpful both in facial aesthetics, so helping rejuvenate the skin at the level of improving fibroblast production, which is the cell that produces collagen, and collagen is the main substrate for the skin that helps it look young and healthy, as well as with just in general skin cell turnover.
Oh, wow. I never knew. My wife talks about it, and I'm like, okay.
And if you kind of, you know, I always think back to first principles, like what's really going on here? You know, red light didn't exist in caveman days. Well, what did exist was just exposure to sunlight and sun therapy, and sunlight in general, in the right doses helps with vitamin D production, but also sun is the ultimate red light because it has the full spectrum of light. You know, when we talk about red light, it's not just putting a red plastic sheet in front of a light and that's red light. No, it's a specific wavelength of light that's emitted between 500 to about 600 nanometers. And infrared light, which is outside of the visible spectrum, is something that also helps stimulate the cells and produce cell turnover.
Wow. This is one of, hey folks, stick with us. We'll be right back with more Dr. John. We're going to talk about AI, robotics, the reality, and actually what happens now when there's breast augmentation, how it can be done without an implant. So stick with us. We'll be right back with more Saving with Steve.
More expert advice for having a happier relationship with money still to come on the Saving with Steve show on UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the show that is here to help you achieve your financial goals. It's the Saving with Steve show. Now here's your host, Steve Sexton on UK Health Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the Saving with Steve show. We're talking about the ins and outs of money, and we're talking with Dr. John Kvesky. We've been talking about how women are removing their implants. We've talked about some of the issues with that. We've talked about the future filters that, you know, what's happening with kids. We're talking how you can start identifying if you're actually having breast implant illnesses. There's some ahas there. You're definitely going to want to listen to that again. But right now, let's talk about what AI, robotics, augmentation realities are actually doing in the operating room today. And you know what? We hear about a whole bunch of different things, but we want to stay away from the science fiction. So we got Dr. John talking to us about that too. So you know what? Talk to us about what AI does in the surgery room.
Yeah, we live in an interesting time. So my first interest in AI was over 10 years ago, and I helped start a company using AI to analyze medical images to see things that doctors can't see with their eyes. And so if you think about it strictly from the perspective of eyeballs looking at screens, and what can we do with that? Well, the human eye, even the best trained radiologist can only look at, maybe in their lifetime, somewhere between 100,000 to a million scans, whereas a computer can be trained to look at millions, billions of scans. And that makes the ability of a computer to detect something that's not visible to the human eye much more based on different kinds of patterns. So the use of AI is becoming more and more as a tool that doctors can use to increase their ability. The same way that doctors probably 1,000 years ago never used a stethoscope, but once the stethoscope came around, it became kind of almost impossible to imagine a doctor wouldn't use some sort of tool to increase their ability. And the same thing is happening with AI. And it's being used everywhere, but still not as widely implemented as it could be. So one of the more common places is medical imaging. So using AI to pick up things that doctors can't see with their eyes or to detect things in the blood. My particular interest is the use of AI in the operating room, specifically in the world of surgical robotics. So I've worked with and advised Neuralink, which is a company that uses or is developing brain-computer interfaces, literally a implant that goes in the brain to help patients who are paralyzed or unable to use their muscles for any number of diseases such as ALS or spinal cord paralysis from the neck down. The use of AI in surgical robotics is interesting because a robot is far more precise, and I'm happy to admit that I'm down to the millimeter level. Even though I'm highly trained and done thousands of hours of surgery, I will never be as precise as a robot. And in the world of surgical robotics, even surgery is not safe, meaning even surgeons may be at risk of their job at some point in the future. And that is something I'm happy to relinquish control of eventually. Any surgery that is filmed, so that could be laparoscopic surgery, anytime a camera is used during surgery, that's potentially data that can be used by a robot to train and understand what's happening, which can either be used as a helper, an intelligent helper at some point for a surgeon who's operating, or eventually to replace steps of surgery. Now, when we talk about Neuralink or brain-computer interfaces, a large part of that surgery is performed by a robot. A robot is inserting with extremely high precision and accuracy into the brain, in between little tiny millimeter-sized blood vessels, electrodes that are thinner than a human hair, in between the pulsing of a brain beat to beat. To give you kind of an analogy, So what the robot is doing is literally inserting little thin electrodes thinner than a human hair in between blood vessels to avoid damaging the blood vessels while the brain is pulsing and beating. Human can't do that accurately without potentially damaging the blood vessels, or if they did, it would take a lot longer. So AI is using that platform to, first of all, identify the safe places like a needle in a haystack where the electrode can go, and then to insert it in between those beats of the brain. Because on a microscopic scale, when the brain is pulsing and beating, there's about a split second where the brain's not moving, and you can safely do that. To give you an analogy to scale that out, it would be kind of like, imagine a tree blowing in the wind, and you're trying to very carefully draw back an arrow and shoot it right in between the leaves.
Oh.
That's pretty hard. I don't know how often, you'd probably have to be a highly skilled archer to be able to do that. And that's something that today live is happening repeatedly at Neuralink when patients are receiving an implant. And what that's doing is completely unlocking unknown capability or capabilities that were never seen before for patients who are paralyzed from the neck down. So these are patients that would otherwise have to rely 100% of the time on friends and family to take care of them. But now they can control anything that can be controlled with basically a mouse with their brain because they now have this implant that sits there that allows them to click on things and to function with incredibly more capacity than they were before. When you scale that out en masse in the world of surgical robotics, any procedure that's done with a video camera where you are now gathering data and you can potentially train a robot, all surgical specialties become suddenly much more interesting from the perspective of what a robot can do in surgery. Whether it's removing bone and installing a joint replacement for a knee, that could be done more accurately with more precision by a robot. Or laparoscopic surgery, removing somebody's gallbladder, you could do potentially far more carefully with much more precision. Heart surgery, literally every surgical specialty is at risk. The two specialties that I think are going to be sort of the last standing specialties in surgery that may not be replaced by robots yet are probably trauma surgery and aesthetic surgery. And I don't say that just because I'm biased, but because the data to perform or to record and train a robot to do trauma surgery or aesthetic surgery is highly subjective and not well recorded. Trauma surgery requires extremely fast movement, and somebody who has suffered a gunshot wound or a car accident, there's a number of injuries that need to be stabilized quickly, and it usually requires somebody to move extremely fast. And there's also just not usually a lot of intraoperative video, so there's not a camera in the operating room recording every step of the surgery. And the same thing with aesthetic surgery. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and what one surgeon or one patient might find beautiful might be completely different from what another patient or surgeon finds. So it's hard to create these standardized objective visual representations of what is a good idea or what is a good outcome. So in a nutshell, surgical robotics is absolutely coming the same way we have with driverless cars. It's just a matter of time and how much data we can collect to create safe outcomes.
Wow, we're back to the Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
The references. So let's talk about, you know what, obviously we don't want to use implants. So how do we do breast implants or breast augmentation nowadays?
So my practice and what I've spent the past 10 years focusing on is using fat as a safe alternative to implants. The breast, if you look at it anatomically, is made up of breast gland and fat. And so my thought around that is the safest and most obvious solution is to learn and how to use the tools of tissue engineering by using your own fat as a way to change the shape or size of the breast. Traditionally, fat grafting has been around for decades. It's been used as a safe alternative for over 50 years. However, there's a lot of myth and there's a lot of misunderstandings about the way fat is used. And so if you ask many surgeons who are not comfortable or don't use fat grafting as a large part of their practice, they'll say that patients often don't have enough fat, the fat doesn't survive, and it is also has fraught with complications. That's partly true. The surgeons aren't wrong. However, if this is what you spend all of your time doing, you start to see all the complications, and you can there's ways to improve fat graft retention. There's ways to improve the harvesting and collecting of fat. So for even patients who don't have a lot of fat, there's a way to get more of it. And there's a way to safely and very technically inject the fat so you don't have complications as much. So I can go through each of those. So first of all, myth number one about harvesting fat if a patient is thin or is not enough. Most people, in fact, everybody has a thin layer of fat every part of their body under the skin. It's just part of the way the anatomy is structured. Is in order to be able to insulate the body and stay warm, there's a thin layer of fat everywhere. And even if you're very thin, there's still fat there. It's just a question of the skill and technique used to harvest that fat. So for patients who are on the smaller side, I'm still usually able to get enough fat. It just requires taking smaller amounts of fat from more areas around the body. So even on smaller patients with a BMI of, less than 20, I'm able to collect small amounts of fat from a number of places, and I get enough fat that I can work with to shape and mold a breast. If you're on the smaller side, there's pros and cons, which is the downside is you may need to collect more fat from more places, but on the plus side, or the benefit is you don't need as much fat to make a big difference. Now, myth number two, which is the fat doesn't survive. Again, that's partly true. The fat doesn't survive, but not all of it. So there's a range. If you look at the literature, about 50 to 80% of the fat will survive after a fat transfer. What that means is, if I took a handful of seeds and just threw them in the grass, not all of the grass is going to grow. But if you're very careful and very selective about how those seeds are placed, you can increase the survival and growth of the grass. The same works with fat cells. So I've developed a protocol, it's 7 steps, and each step increases this fat survival by a few percentage points. So I'm able to consistently see fat graft survival in the 70 to 80% range and sometimes even higher. So the first thing I do is I collect the fat under very low suction pressure. When removing the fat from the body with liposuction, the trauma of the negative pressure can often damage the fat cells. But if you do it with low enough pressure, the fat cells don't get as disturbed. The second thing is I keep the fat in a closed container. The fat never leaves this closed system, so it doesn't get exposed to the air, and there's less risk of contamination with things like bacteria. The third is I actually add antibiotics to the fat, which helps, again, minimize the risk of any kind of infection. The fourth thing is I add something called surfactant to the fat, which is a molecule that's a little bit similar to soap. And what it does is it helps separate out the fat cells that are not going to survive and any debris in the fat compared to the fat that will survive.
Oh.
Yeah. Number five, which we touched about briefly, is I use red light therapy during the procedure. Specifically, I apply a red light device to the fat while it's being collected, which helps stimulate the mitochondria and the stem cells in the fat. So while they're living outside of the body and surviving on just the air and what they're surrounded by, it improves the survival of the fat cells. It sort of supercharges the fat cells before they go back into the body. So once they're back in and looking for those new blood vessels to survive, they have a higher chance of survival. Now, the last two steps is I inject only the middle two thirds of the fat, which has been shown to have the highest amount of stem cells. And so that's like choosing the best seeds of grass to put back into the ground.
Yeah.
And the very last step, which I think is one of the most important, is I use a micro droplet technique. So that I'm injecting really tiny little bits of fat with a power device. It's almost like using a power sprayer to make sure I'm coating the areas evenly, instead of what's traditionally done is using a handheld injection syringe, where a surgeon will manually just apply pressure and kind of, it's like painting with a brush versus the power sprayer. And that's really important because it's like planting one little seed at a time instead of these big globs. So those seven steps I've seen improve the fat graft survival from, you know, the 50 to 60% range to well above 70 to 80%. So we talked about myth one, which is what do you do if you don't have enough fat? We have solutions and things around that. Two is the fat doesn't survive. And the last thing is the complications associated with fat grafting. So there is a known risk of something called fat necrosis or oil cysts, which is when the fat's not properly injected, a large ball of fat cannot survive. And my technique for addressing that is using that micro droplet technique, making sure I'm injecting really small bits of fat and not overfilling the breast to make sure the fat survives.
That's wonderful. You know what? We're right at the end and I actually want to listen more. But do me a favor, if you could share your information, because I know there's a number of women who would love to get in contact with you, especially if they, you know, to see if they have that, the breast implant illness, and maybe look at doing some breast implants with you. Mm-hmm. So if you could share that information, that'd be great, folks. We're going to put it on the website. And we'll make sure everybody does it. But right now, if you could share with us, that'd be great, John.
Absolutely. So the easiest and best place to reach me is through Instagram. My Instagram is drjohn.k. That's drjohn.k. There you can find information about what I've shared today, as well as some before and afters, and just to get a better understanding of what I'm about. Also, my website, which I'll share, is auraesthetica.com. That's auraesthetica.com. And there you can see more information about the work that I do.
John, I really very much appreciate being here today. You've dispelled a lot of myths. You've given, hey, this is what happens step by step, which everybody was really looking for. And red light therapy, that's a biggie. With that, again, I want to thank you so much for being here. With that, I want to thank you all for joining us today. Look forward to seeing you next time right here on Saving with Steve.
Thank you for joining us on the Saving with Steve show, hosted by Steve Sexton on UK Health Radio. To learn more about the show and how to become a guest or sponsor, visit savingwithsteve.us. That's savingwithsteve.us. Join us again next time as we continue to talk about everything under the sun that relates to you having a healthier, happier relationship with money. This has been the Saving with Steve show, hosted by Steve Sexton on UK Health Radio.